Love, Lust, and Laughter with Dr. Diana Wiley and Billy Sage, Fridays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Wiley and Sage, Love, Lust, and Laughter. I'm your co-host, Billy Sage, along with Dr. Diana Wiley, and today, once again on the show, back since they're appearing on March, Dr. Pepper Schwartz, AARP's sex and relationship expert. She's written 16 books on the dating habits and sensuality of couples and singles. Her mission is to improve the lives of aging boomers by enhancing their relationships and offering counsel on everything from sex and health issues to communication and dating in midlife and beyond. If you've ever wondered, how do you look for a life partner after 50 and enjoy sexual adventures along the way?
You'll find out. Like a massive
now,
business, you know.
Here's your host, Dr. Diana.
Hello, everybody. We're so happy today to have Dr. Pepper Schwartz. She is here for the second time. She was on this program, Love, Lust, and Laughter, in March. And Dr. Pepper Schwartz has appeared repeatedly on the Oprah Show and the Today Show. But today we have her, and I'm so pleased. Thank you, Dr. Pepper Schwartz, for being on this radio program.
I wanted to be involved in it. It was like $100,000 in, and
Pepper,
I don't do that. I can't.
Hello, Pepper. Hello, Pepper. Well, I think we have her, but I don't know that she is listening to us. So let me. Pepper, are you there?
I am.
Great. We just introduced you, and I was telling our listening audience that you've been on Oprah many times and the Today Show and on and on and on, and I'm so pleased that you're on Love, Lust, and Laughter today. You are AARP's sex and relationship expert, and AARP has something like 43 million members, so it's a big organization.
It is. It's the biggest member organization in the world, well, in the country at least.
Yes. And are you enjoying writing for the magazine and for their website? I checked it out, and I really like what you've written.
Oh, thank you very much. I do. I think it's great because you know the people there. You know exactly who you're talking to, or at least have a pretty good sense of the range of it. And I have a little bit of a mission in terms of women who are over 50 and their sexuality. I think we've been, you know, invisible and seen as sometimes laughable and often irrelevant. And screw that, you know. I really
Indeed.
Feel that we're live, physically alive people, and we need to be encouraged and acknowledged.
That's the American Association of Romantic People, right?
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that too, Billy.
You're welcome.
I can use that.
You may.
Yeah, why don't you?
I will.
I would like
I'll credit you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Billy, for that
contribution. Just gaze in my eyes. It's okay.
Pepper has written 16 books. Is it more than that by now? Is it 16
No,
still?
It's that. I'll count one, maybe e-book. I don't know whether to count e-books or not. I did my first e-book on sexuality for women over 50 for a site called Vibrant Nation. So,
first
time I've done that.
But your book that I really want to focus on today, Prime, is a fabulous book. And of course, it is, the subtitle is Adventures and Advice on Sex, Love, and the Sensual Years. And I think it has resonated. It was published in 2007, and I think it's resonated for lots of, mostly women, but I'm sure some men too, but women who need a little more confidence in dating after 50. And you're there with lots of good ideas and self-disclosures.
Well, yeah, I when I was trying to think about this topic, I thought, well, I could write my ordinary book about, you know, what we know about sexuality after 50 and be encouraging. And then I sometimes think, you know, I think the way we all listen more closely is somebody's story.
That's true.
Heck, than an anecdote in a book, you know, anonymously given. And I thought, well, you know, I want to talk about what it's been like for me in hopes that it will both inspire and humanize other women to say, you know, you really don't have to be a Hollywood star to deserve being sexual or being an adventuress or being in love or commanding love. I think, you know, the only models we're given are women who don't look like us. We never looked like them. And we still can have these amazing lives. So, you know, I thought I'd put it out there, what it was like for me to be dating between 55 and 60, which are, again, usually ages that society, you know, often gives a kind of a yetch approach to. And I wanted to make sure that women knew that, you know, my experience had been really good. Not without its nights of tears or rejections. I mean, that's life. But on the whole, just really rewarding. And what, you know, I would do again if I was out there dating, because I thought there were so much more positive things that came out of it than negative. And I think that we own our sexuality. We own our ability for romance. Why would we want to consign that to the junk pile when it's just not necessary?
Indeed. And I'm looking at your book, Prime, and you have advice to myself and others. And at the top of your list was choosing to be a sensualist. And I have the answer to this, but I want you to tell our listening audience, why did you choose to be a sensualist?
Well, I think that's always been my nature. And
yes,
what I chose was not to give it up.
Uh-huh.
Hooray!
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I just think, you know, if you believe in a higher power, we were given bodies. There's something we were supposed to do with these. We were giving bodies that connect with other people's bodies. We don't reproduce asexually in a petri dish or, you know, lay an egg and somebody runs by later and throws some sperm on it. I mean, you know,
goodness.
That's not how we were created. And so why would we not be in touch and use this great thing we've been given? Skin that feels, a heart that bonds, you know, a trigger of nerves and body parts that have orgasms. I mean, that's not just given to a few of us. It's given to all of us.
You write, touch connects us and calms us and even cures us. There was a
Absolutely.
Study at Wilkes University, and it reported that couples who have sexual relations weekly see about a 30% hike in immunoglobulin A.
Mm-hmm.
This is the antibody that fights infection, including colds. So it's there are lots, of course, health benefits from remaining sexual. And
there was some research that came out of Germany with exactly the same research that, you know, if you're having some kind of sexual outlet, even masturbation, your immune responses go up, your T cell suppressor cells go up. It was a whole bunch of recognizably measurable health effects that are not trivial.
And happiness effects. Another study, this one was from the Scandinavian Journal of Economics, and it found that sexual frequency increased to weekly romps will reap the same mood elevation as a $50,000 raise. How about that? And in this economy, that's terrific.
I love that finding. You'll have to send me that citation, Diane. I'd love to use that.
I will, Pepper, for sure. And of course, I remember having coffee with you one day, and you got a call from Newsweek magazine while we were having coffee, and you said that, yeah, sex toy sales were up. And I have read that in this economy, people are staying home a little more often, and so they're buying more sex toys. And if they're mm-hmm. single, they may join internet dating sites more readily because sex helps people relax.
Yeah. I think sometimes when money isn't available, people recenter.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, so, like, what is important, right? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's relationships and it's all the things that relationships provide.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go out there looking for someone to be with. You know, I think most of us, if we have it our way, don't want to be hermits. We crave the attention and company of others. And when those attentions and companies are pleasing, or maybe even extraordinary, that's really the center of our world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've always said that money doesn't buy happiness, and I think a lot of people don't believe that. They think it can buy happiness, but it doesn't. I think it's more common to say, I think it's more real to say that abject poverty can cause unhappiness, but it's not true that just money will give you happiness. I mean, I think most of us know that our happiness lies in people. And in other things, I mean, you know, being who we can be, achieving what we want to achieve, being recognized by who we are, liking ourselves for what we've accomplished. But most of all, it's usually about other people.
Michael Eisner, who was the head of Disney and ABC, now he's retired, he reported on The View just this morning that a study out of Harvard, a longitudinal study, that showed that people were happiest in partnerships, whether that's a partnership with in a marriage or an intimate partnership or a working partnership, but that mm-hmm. so often we need the energy of a partner.
I think that's really true. AARP had some similar findings on our recent 2009 national study, which was basically that people were more sexually active and happier if they had any kind of partner, same sex, opposite sex, even somebody who they visited but didn't live with.
Mm-hmm.
Just some kind of relationship made all the difference in the world. And in fact, actually, the people who were dating were happier than the people who were married. I guess some of those marriages are like holding on by their fingernails. But the idea being that no matter what your age, if you are involved with a partner, even if it's not a committed relationship, even if it's somebody you see some of the time, and as you say, even sometimes if it's a close friend or a
mm-hmm.
or a business partnership that you know really supports you. I know I had a 20-year relationship with a gay man, Philip Blumstein, who was my, I used to call him my day husband. He was incredibly dear to me, and we had a great, I mean, I loved him. I loved him as much as I could love anybody. It wasn't sexual, but it was everything else, and it made me happy.
Well, wasn't he the one that you wrote your first book with?
American Couples with, yeah. We spent
yeah,
night
American
and day
couples,
with each
money,
other for years.
Work, and sex.
We did, and
mm-hmm.
so it was this amazing partnership of, you know, collecting the data, analyze the data, writing the data, promoting the books. Our offices were right next to each other. We were like an old married couple, and it was an extraordinary relationship. So
mm-hmm.
there's many ways of keeping your heart and mind active.
For sure. Now, in your book, Prime, you talk about the critical C's when we're looking for that partner that we've been discussing: compatibility, communication, and chemistry. Those are great C's, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little on that. You talk about it in your book, but why are they so important? I know there's some obvious reasons here, but I would love for you to just talk a little bit more about it.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, chemistry is what distinguishes us, our friends from our lovers. You know, we can,
yes.
you know, love somebody, but the chemistry, that, you know, that zing when you see them, that desire to please them,
mm-hmm.
that lust, the wanting them. I mean, that's just something that we don't understand very well about why it's this person versus that person, but
mm-hmm.
we do know it when we see it. I mean, it's a very distinct feeling. And communication, of course, is, you know, to want to bridge the gap between being alone and being with someone, to be able to talk, to be able to work things out, to be able to be vulnerable, to find out what another person's vulnerability is, to trust. I mean, those are all things that truly deepen and bond a relationship. And then compatibility is, you know, can you live well together? Can you run a life together? Do you want the same things out of life? Do you know how to do the day-to-day stuff in a way that's pleasing, as opposed to feeling conflicted and torn and unhappy and in the way life is going. So you kind of need all three to really make something go the distance. It's what's often confusing is you'll get one of them, you know, and then, you know, like you're terribly attracted to each other, but you don't know how to talk, you don't know how to mend things, and you're going in separate directions. If that's just not going to work.
I love when you say in your book, Prime, that your priorities include mental and physical attraction, and you write, I sometimes joke that I really need a man to do only two things for me, make me laugh and make me moan. That's
well,
so
I mean,
good,
and make me a sandwich.
Yes. Well, it's true in my case. You know, I make a decent living and I have a lot of friends and I live the life I want, but to have somebody who is your lover is a very special niche that a lot of other things will not fulfill. And to enjoy life with somebody, to share it, to laugh about it, to enjoy it together. You know, that in chemistry is pretty much my number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 choices.
Of course. And Billy Sage, love to have a little bit of the male perspective here. And you're a very
sure.
funny guy. And the rumor has it that you're also a very good lover with your wife. I don't know this, but Billy was my sidekick in Hawaii for a year of the 5 years I was on the radio there. And so, Billy, what's the idea of making a woman laugh and moan? What do you have anything to say more about that?
Well, let's see. We could start with a really hideous pun, but
what would that be,
about
Bill?
In the bedroom, yes. I misunderstood. I didn't know if you said, Billy, I was really good at mayo or male, but I generally hold the mayo when I'm acting like a male because I don't really need the mayo, but there are other things, which are a couple of accoutrements and giggle tools and toys sometimes are just spice to the mix. A lot of times, men find and women find in the bedroom that they love each other, but conventionality rules the day just because of somehow even that which is wonderful can ironically become routine. You wouldn't like to have caviar every single meal. You'd get sick of it.
Mm-hmm.
So occasionally, I like to think of the human body as the painting, a beautiful masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there is nothing wrong occasionally. I mean, you can look at the canvas in the studio as it's being created, and there it is, but sometimes it's nice if the studio is the same as the Louvre and you're going for a wonderful work of art. You complement the beautiful work of art with a magnificent frame as well, if you get the analogy.
Of course.
So every once in a while, you know, a little, and it's okay to change frames once in a while. Keep the same painting, but change the frame. And
then that'll keep the dopamine flowing, and dopamine needs a little novelty.
That's right, and sometimes those immunoglobulins can, actually, if you pronounce it like the old summer samba, you can sing it, immunoglobulin, immunoglobulin, immunoglobulin.
And if you can sing, we're going to do that.
Okay, we don't have to, but if you just want, just remember one of the greatest things I learned about romance. If a light sleeper sleeps with a light on, it does not necessarily mean that a hard sleeper sleeps with a window open. She's laughing and moaning. I knew it. See, I told you.
I'm reminded of a guy who said to me, "My wife insists on turning off the lights when we make love, and that doesn't bother me. It's the hiding that seems so cruel."
And times are tough. I mean, I saw a polygamist with only one wife. It's just, you know, we got to turn this economy around.
Yes, well...
Oh, by the way.
Yes.
Our studio line, there are people out there. If you want to call in and make Dr. Pepper Schwartz or Dr. Diana Wiley moan, the number is 888-874-4888.
Well, I don't think we're going to be moaning, Billy, but I think...
Well, it could be hideous puns.
We'll be informing...
This is true.
Yes.
But if anybody volunteers, sometimes to get people over their shyness, if you have a really terrible joke, you might make a moan in a wholesome way. you might get some insight. But anyway, if you're brave or you have questions, don't be afraid to call us. It's a toll-free number. Once again, that's 888-874-4888.
So Dr. Pepper Schwartz is writing as the sex and relationship, love relationship expert for AARP. I read on the website, which is aarp.org/naked, what is it?
Naked Truth.
Naked Truth, thank you. So /naked truth, which is the name of your column. And you had this question, did you learn how to date after 50? What would you suggest we don't do? And your answer was very good. You explained that you left a marriage of 23 years and you had to kind of contemplate on what you wanted and who you were, and so you suggested that people not do the following. And you started by saying, don't whine about past husbands or wives or children. That's a death knell, isn't it? And why do people do that?
It's a good question. I don't know. I think people think they're being honest. You know, here's where I've been. Here's what my life was like. Here's what I suffered.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a drag to hear it. I mean, and somebody thinks, well, that could be me she's whining about.
Oh,
me.
Oh, stop. You're turning me on.
Yes. Well, generally, it's not a turn on.
No,
I was being sarcastic.
To complain
about
a past.
Yeah, he was being sarcastic.
Yeah.
Was I?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, for most people, it's a big turn off. You know, like, nobody likes to hear negative things, complaints, sorry stories, even if some of them are quite deserved. I mean, and the very fact is that, you know, maybe there's a time when that's appropriate, but it's not when you're meeting somebody.
No.
It's not before you've fallen in love and you trust each other and you want to know the deepest parts of your past histories. So, I don't know. I think there's something with a lot of people. They feel like they have to get it all out in the first coffee. And, of course, it's going to make somebody run the other way really quickly.
Really quickly. Your second point is come to the table with happiness and positive attitude.
Right.
And don't bring your worries. Again, say that. I think people respond so much better, of course, to somebody who's positive and happy.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. We all want to be around with somebody who's up, who's fun, who enlarges our life, who embraces life, who's positive. I have met with people, even when they were seriously ill, where they refused to bring that to the table. That was their, they kept that in a compartment for other times, but if they were at dinner or something, you would never know that their life was deeply challenged and that fear and pain were part of it. They made sure that they were delightful dining companions. And, of course, that meant they got invited back more. Everybody could feel sympathetic about someone who's going through something very bad, but they don't want to be dragged down by it. The only people who do that are psychiatrists or best friends.
Exactly. I think it's also one reason that people newly in love are often so attractive to other people, because they're so radiant and happy, and they just will be that much more like a magnet, drawing people in.
I think that's a great point.
Yeah.
No, I think that's exactly right, Diane. I think it's a great point. When we meet somebody who's in love and happy, we just bask in their glow.
Yes, and why it's so much fun to be out with a happy couple as opposed to a bickering couple.
Oh, God, absolutely. With a couple who really are not getting along, you don't ever want to go out with them again. It's just, it wears at you. It's a cost.
Yes. So your third point in what not to do is don't feel you have to tell this person every bad thing about yourself. They don't need to know until there's enough evidence that things could get serious. Another very excellent point.
Oh, absolutely.
You
know, I know a woman who has an autistic child, and he's so much a part of her life that, you know, all of these first dates, she'd be talking about all the tough things that she and her husband went through with this child and how it broke up their relationship and how much she has to do for this kid. And amazingly enough, nobody is generally prepared to take that on unless it resonates with their own, you know, experience with the child, et cetera, in which case then it's a bonding situation. But in most cases, that's something that really no one needs to hear about unless things get serious, that's going to affect the progress of the relationship.
And just between us, I know who you're talking about. And I had lunch with her, and yes, that is kind of the centerpiece of her life, this
right,
autistic child.
Right, and she's a beautiful
and
woman.
She's a fabulous woman. She's bright and attractive and all of that. But
if I could, I would say keep that tap down. It's important, and keep it in a situation where people have asked for that and want to know more,
mm-hmm.
and but not in the romantic area.
Now, you have two more points on in answering this question from this woman through AARP's website, and I guess you were doing a chat room, perhaps, and
mm-hmm.
you said, don't get discouraged right away. I've had people go out on 3 dates and say they aren't going to do it again. That's not too right. If you go out on enough dates, you'll find somebody, so don't quit too soon. I must say, as a widow of quite a few years now, I've gone out on lots of dates through eHarmony and through Match.com. And but I'm such an optimist. I keep positive thoughts, and I know that it is, even statistically, it's a game of numbers. And
it is.
Yeah.
It is, and you've met some people that were worth knowing, and
absolutely
where there was some heat and some light, you know. I mean, sometimes what's important is you've met someone that changed your life for a while, even if it's not forever.
Exactly.
I know, you know, as the relationship expert for Perfect Match, I do know at our site that we get many, many letters from people who, you know, finally find someone. They say, I'd almost given up hope, but here he or she was exactly what I wanted, and really glad I hung in there. You know, we also get a lot of letters saying, you know, I've been out there 3 times and nobody's called me, and I'm, you know, I think this whole thing is a pile of whatever. And, you know, I'm just saying, you need a backbone, you need to be resilient, you need to be optimistic, and you need to enjoy those, you know, those sort of ones that just miss, because they're good even if they didn't go the whole distance. If they were interesting enough to get you going romantically and sexually or intellectually for a while, that wasn't wasted just because it didn't end up in marriage or
absolutely
commitment.
And if you keep your eyes open, you continue to learn and you continue to improve, and you can do that best in any kind of a relationship, even if it's a new one that maybe won't go into marriage, which leads me to your fifth and last point. And you write, and most important, don't forget to listen. You don't have to do all the tap dancing. I like that, Pepper. He should get a word in edgewise. That is so important. Listening. Active listening.
That might
course.
Be the first one, I tell you.
Yeah.
You know, have you ever been with somebody who talked your ear off and they didn't know one thing more about you at the end of a half an hour than they did at the beginning of the half an hour?
Yes.
I mean,
and they tend to be very narcissistic, ultimately.
Right. Now, some people do that because they're nervous. They can't stand
mm-hmm.
the face. They're, you know, they're worried, so they talk too much that way. Other people are talking that way because they don't really care about anybody but themselves. But if your audience out there is somebody who's a nervous talker or talks to fill in spaces or whatever, tell them not only is it easier to listen, it's more interesting, and you don't have to do all the work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you're much more likely to have the beginnings of a deeper relationship if there's give and take.
You might
right.
gently suggest, do you like lip staples?
Oh, dear.
I mean that in a good way, you know, and see if they're just quiet.
Yes.
Just a suggestion.
Well, you know, I mean, that one might not have been my first thought.
No.
No, you could say, like, okay, so how did you become an ex, or where did you go after school, and you know, what was your first job like? Mine was, you know, so important in the rest of the things that followed. Was it like that way for you? Or whatever you can to find out that the person's life, what mattered to them, where their turning points were, what their interests are. I mean, it's a little bit like a job interview, and you need to, both people in a job interview need to know about each other. The employer needs to know, if this is the person for the job, and the person is looking for the job needs to impress them, but also needs to find out if it's the job they want. So there need to be very positive, somewhat managed exchanges, but you know what they are given what your goal is. In a job situation, it's to either get the job and maybe find out if it's worth getting, and in a relationship situation, it's to find out if this is a relationship worth being in, but also to make sure that if you do think so, this other person is going to think so too.
And you write in Prime that your priorities in looking at criteria for men would be character, and that would be values, ethics, mm-hmm. trustworthiness, similarity of lifestyle and long-term goals, desire to communicate and the ability to do so, and then we've already talked about the mental and physical attraction, the laughing and the moaning. But, you're not going to find out anything about the guy, the character, similarity of lifestyle, communication, and so on, if you're doing all the talking. And
right.
And you just listed, Pepper, some open-ended questions, which, of course, are important to ask, which really gives some room for answers from the guy.
Yeah.
And as
you want to be
listeners.
Careful not to answer ask for questions that can only have a yes or a no. I mean, then you don't know what to say next.
Yeah.
You need to answer questions that have an open-ended space to fill in.
So, Billy, I think you're going to take us to our break.
That's right. As good listening, we might listen to the station break here and remind everybody that you can call us at 888-874-4888 on Progressive Radio Network. This is the Wiley and Sage Love, Lust, and Laughter Show.
Calibro affascini il tuo cuore, e se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore,
mai tuoi piedi cadrà per età, mai tuoi piedi cadrà per età.
Happy feet, da-da-da, happy feet, da-da-da, happy feet.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. Every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
Hi, this is Mike Fader. I'm doing a new show here on PRN every Thursday following Gary Null from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. It's called The Turning Point. What will we talk about? Well, everything from birth to death and most things in between. I'll be using stories in the news and personal observations from my own life. And from time to time, I'll be taking your calls. So please join me, Mike Fader, every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time for The Turning Point on PRN.
To the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
We are back with Wiley and Sage Love, Lust, and Laughter with our special guest, Dr. Pepper Schwartz, and we're figuring out the best way to talk sometimes is to listen.
Yes, we are. Dr. Pepper Schwartz is the author of 16 books. The one we're focusing on today was published in 2007, Prime Adventures and Advice on Sex, love and the sensual years. Now, we've been talking mainly about partnerships, and but you do say in Prime about pleasing yourself, and one way of staying sexually alive is taking care of your own pleasure with your own hand or a number of really effective sex toys. That reminds me of a quote from a doctor, an MD, Dr. Saz, and he said, "Masturbation is the primary sexual activity of mankind. In the 19th century, it was a disease. In the 20th, and I'll add, and 21st century, it's a cure." So masturbation, I have older women who don't have a partner and are not having intercourse, and I'll say, you know, you really need to be masturbating with a dildo to keep your vaginal walls supple. Otherwise, with a lack of estrogen and all that, they're going to thin too readily. And I know you don't say that in your book, but you do say that masturbation will be a sexual mainstay of one's life.
Oh, I totally support what you're saying. I mean, the fact is that these are muscles like any other muscle. If we told someone not to use their left arm for 20 years, what do we think would happen to that arm?
Indeed.
I mean, it would become non-functional or extremely weakened. That's why when somebody breaks a leg or whatever, there's a rigorous rehabilitation program. Mm-hmm. Well, the vaginal walls are held together by muscles. They're you know, irrigated by the sweating lubrication that comes with arousal.
Mm-hmm.
If they're neither used nor aroused, they're going to atrophy.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is that if you have had a situation where those muscles have atrophied, they can be brought back through a series of Kegel exercises, sometimes with estrogen-based creams or suppositories or rings. I mean, there's lots that you can do, but why get there in the first place? You know, by masturbating and by keeping your sexual life alive, that will never happen.
Yeah, I think that self-pleasuring is essential between relationships to keep yourself juicy, and even for the man, erections are good for erections in terms of blood flow and the nitric oxide inside the penis. So it's all good, and it's important. And of course, with women learning to have orgasms, they must self-stimulate so they know what they like.
Right.
And,
no, it's all good. I mean, it's just crazy to me when I think about, when I look at the women over 50, about 50% of them masturbate, and I think, what's wrong with the other 50%? They're really missing something important. With younger men, about 85 or 90% of them masturbate. When you get with the men over 50, you know, maybe a third to 40% of them do. So it's kind of, and also, I mean, it's much different with inside and outside of relationships, but there's a good thing to be said about it within relationships as well.
Yeah.
Hold on a second. Anyhow, I'm sorry. So I think the fact is that it's important to think of it as within relationships, because you shouldn't lay all of your needs on your partner either. There's many of times when, you know, it's kind of itch you have to scratch, or you'd like to have, make love, but your partner's not in the mood. And, you know, instead of forcing them or doing a guilt trip on them or something else, you know, do it yourself. No big deal.
Do it yourself and have your partner watch. And it's educational and sometimes arousing. So
if they want to watch and you want to be seen, fine. But it's also something you can just say, okay, this is my thing right now.
That's right.
Wasn't it Rodney Dangerfield who once said, 95% of all people masturbate and the other 5% lie?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, I wish he was correct, but he was just hopeful.
So the condition known as anhedonia actually exists?
Remind me what that means. Is that
anhedonia, like hedonism?
Against pleasure?
Hedonism is a total... Anhedonia is just somebody who is incapable of pleasure.
Yeah, it exists, but it's rare, as far as I know.
I think it is, yeah. I mean, the fact you'd have to have something wrong with your nerve system delivery of feeling. People who have no delivery of pleasure also often have no delivery of pain, which is also very dangerous. They can't feel it, you know, when they're hurt. So it's there's some tough stuff out there.
When I worked at the UCLA Female Sexual Medicine Center, the physician there talked about a connection that she had discovered over some years, that women who did not masturbate as teenagers and up until about 25 probably had not made those nerve passages from the genitals to the brain operative. So these women had less of a chance of being orgasmic. And if they did learn to have orgasms, and I've had some clients like this, they almost always need a sex toy, a vibrator, that will go so much faster than a hand or a tongue.
Mm-hmm.
They need that extra stimulation.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know about that study about it being a strong correlation to teenage masturbation or not. I think that's a fascinating finding. If it were replicated and if we believed it, it would get very important to encourage young women to masturbate early so their body, you know, retains that ability to have an orgasm.
Yeah, it also it may keep them from having intercourse before they're ready. I embarrassed my daughter to death when she was in high school. She's now in her early 30s, with married and with a baby. But I used to talk to her and her friends about mutual masturbation, that if you're in a committed relationship, it's better to masturbate in front of each other than to have intercourse and risk pregnancy and STDs and everything else. And yet it can be very intimate.
Well, I think the problem with it is it's too intimate for a lot of people. You know, intercourse is one of those things where sometimes people, they have intercourse, they close their eyes, they don't talk, and nothing is communicated. It's a very non-intimate experience, where mutual masturbation requires looking at each other and sharing this experience and talking about, you know, what you're going to do. And so I think sometimes, you know, we think of intercourse as the end result of everything, but there are other things that are actually quite a bit more intimate, require more conversation, negotiation, expression, et cetera.
That's Trust. Right. And I find when I give homework assignments to some of my couples, and I suggest that when they can do that, it's kind of a breakthrough, because masturbation is so often so private.
You know, I remember David
Pepper. Oh, dear. I think we've lost her, but maybe she'll be back with anything. Yeah, okay, you cut out for a minute. You started by saying you remember David what?
It's Snarsh, who wrote The Passionate Marriage.
Yeah, right.
And he talks about eye-gazing, where he asks people to hold contact with their eyes with each other while they're making love, and he finds that in the... Hello?
Yeah, I think you're cutting out a little bit.
Sort of noises here that I don't know why they're happening, but anyhow, he says that he finds that in the beginning they have trouble gazing at each eyes without closing their eyes for even a few seconds, and that part of it is that they have to learn how to keep their eyes open to engage each other, to look to, you know, eyes as the pathways to the soul. It's so open, it's so vulnerable, it's so trusting, it's so intimate that couples really have to learn how to do it.
Yes, so that if you keep your eyes open during orgasm, that can be really mind-blowing.
Oh, absolutely.
You
That's
wrote...
the PhD, though.
What is it?
That's the PhD of sex, though.
The PhD of sex, that's true. The PhD of sex could also be for oral sex, put head down. PhD? Not very good, but of course, oral sex can be so intimate, too. I mean, if we compare it with intercourse? And there are some, I think, kind of evolved men who really enjoy performing cunnilingus, and if a woman is able to orgasm that way, he likes being right there, and he can feel, it's like command central, he can feel that his woman is having a great orgasm, and he's right there for it, and he likes it.
Oh, absolutely. I do think that's a man who's very comfortable, not only with his sexuality, but really and truly enjoys women.
Yes. And then the woman who enjoys performing fellatio, the proverbial blowjob, I don't know why it's called that, because it's really not, you're not blowing and it's not a job, but anyway.
One of the funniest cartoons ever, if I may interject.
Yes, please.
There was probably Playboy, a cartoon by Brian Savage, probably circa 1964 or 5. The perspective is one of those old hotels with the open transom window above the door. And one of the housekeepers is walking by, looking up with a sort of a stunned expression on her face. And through the transom, you hear the caption, "Suck, Mary Beth, suck. Blow is just a figure of speech." I remember that.
Yeah, there was false advertising. That's true. But the point is that women who really enjoy giving blowjobs often really get into their own power over the man's pleasure. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in a very positive way, of course.
Now I've got you, my pretty, and I'll take care of your little dog, too.
what do you think about that?
I agree. I think there is something very powerful feeling of being able to deliver a great deal of pleasure to someone, to have them surrender to you in their pleasure and trust you and be grateful for and need what you're giving them. And in whichever way you do that, there is a sense of accomplishment and pride that you've been able to give this person that much pleasure. I mean, that's certainly the way it should be. If you feel like it's work, something's terribly wrong.
Indeed. Now, you wrote in the AARP magazine in January, February of this year, Love American Style, where studies in France and the United States were compared. Mm-hmm. And I'm just reading from this article in the magazine that you wrote. The biggest difference between the French and Americans revolves around, you guessed it, sex. In response to the statement, "True love can exist without a radiant sex life," 77% of Americans aged 50 to 64 said yes, but 56% of the French in this age range answered absolutely not. Why the cultural disparity? And Mitch Hepper, who is a man that I know and like so much, and actually we at the World Congress for Sexology in Paris went around Paris with him and some other colleagues. But anyway, he answered, he said, "The French lifestyle is slower, more sensual. The French allow space in their lives for sex and a playfulness between sexes. We keep tighter reins on ourselves." And that's so true.
This is why the Germans had no problem rolling in 1940.
Probably.
We are very uptight, but even worse.
But that's just me. Well, to make a long story short, we lost the war. Anyway.
Yeah. So you wrote that article at the beginning of this year, and we sort of assume that, in that article you talked about Americans actually having love relationships, but it's the French who are a little more open and playful about the sex.
Yeah, I think that in America we justify sex by love, and I think the French justify sex by sex.
Oh, good. I love how you put that. I'm going to quote you on that.
Okay, feel free.
That's great. Yeah, they do make more time, and isn't that essential, that we make more time? And, of course, older lovers can have more time and privacy. And I always say, you know, ideally the empty nest should become the love nest. And we find, and this was quoted in an AARP magazine of maybe 10 years ago, that in general men become, after 55, say, men become more romantic and women become more assertive.
I think that's all true. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's all true. But, I mean, one hopes that when one retires or when he has less of an intense work life or it's less the center of one's ego, that time is used to embroider and enlarge the relationship, take more time, give it more intimacy, you know, have a trip, for example, that doesn't have to end on Sunday and therefore has more time for the two people to, you know, just really have time for emotions to emerge and playfulness and intimacy to happen. I mean, the best of all possible worlds, those years, you know, post-retirement or later on, are ones where you can develop what you have together and not, you know, shove it in the background for lack of time or because your psyche is, you know, split three ways between three kids, a job, and the relationship getting kind of the short end of the stick. I think that what happens in later day relationships is they either get much tighter, much closer, much more intimate, or the centrifugal force, the lack of having that together, unwinds them.
You answered a question from Betty on AARP, what attracts a mature male to a mature woman once the hormones have stopped, and I love your answer, of course. You said he likes her wisdom, her energy, her self-knowledge, her acceptance of him. He likes the fact that she knows who she is, and he loves it when their interests overlap. The mature woman and her possible radiance, and her acceptance of him, that's a very important part, Pepper. I'm so glad you said that, too.
Well, we all want to be accepted at some point. And as we get older, we say, hey, come on, this is who I am. I want somebody who both sees it and appreciates it. That doesn't mean I don't recognize my flaws or my shortcomings, whether it would be a quick temper or lack of attention to detail or whatever it was that one had. We're not being able to ask to be forgiven for the things we do that aren't our best self. But we are asked to be accepted, known, and to be liked, and to be, I guess the word would just be to give a pass to some of those things that are unfinished or not as good as they might be, but are part of the package. And I think everybody at an older age in particular says, see me for who I am, and I like to feel that for the main part, it's all what you want and like, and for the part that isn't, that you accept it and you don't make me feel bad about it. That we have the right and the wisdom to have more private space and go our separate ways some of the time, but that we're drawn together because of how much we like to be together and how much we feel affection and love for each other. And I think that's true. I think a lot of women and men think, oh, nobody's going to like me. I've got this 30 pounds I shouldn't have, or I really never became famous, or I wasn't, you know, I have a modest income, or, you know, I have a limp, or whatever it is that people think that is excluding them from love. It's not. It's not. What excludes them from love is if they don't, somebody feels safe, and they don't have a good sense of themselves, which they like, and they show that they like themselves. And that's what people want. They want somebody who likes themselves, who is able to accept and like them, and who isn't going to be a downer, whose life is not, you know, unraveling all the time, who can appreciate and open up the world to each other. It doesn't have anything to do, for the most part, with money or being glamorous or being exactly the right weight. I think people use often that as an excuse for why they can't find somebody, but I don't think that's it.
I agree with you. You express it beautifully in such an articulate way. In general, I think for many older people, the physicality is just less important.
Right.
You know, that inner, it sounds like such a cliche, but that inner beauty. And also, you're able to kind of say, how do I feel when I'm with this person? Do I feel good? Do I feel good about myself and about the other person? And you have, with more life experience, you have maybe a better way to figure that out. And
no,
I think,
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I heard one guy say, and I think older guys understand this, he said, making love to a woman is like baking a turkey. You have to preheat the oven, stuff, baste, make some gravy, put it in for 2 hours, take it out, not done yet, another hour, finally it's ready. Men, It's a microwave cooking. Rip off the package, 3 minutes, ding, got a nap for an hour.
Wait, do I get to make stuffing? Just asking.
You wish.
Well, there's a lot to that. You know, if you see it as a process, and it takes some time, and you give it what it deserves, and you focus on what you're doing, it's going to be good.
It's going to be good. And in the same article where for AARP magazine, you quote Helen Fisher, and of course we both, I think, appreciate the research she's done.
Sure.
And you wrote that her brain scans of people in long-term relationships shows increased activity in the area associated with calm, but none in the region associated with anxiety. So even with long-term relationships, we have that friendship, we have that calmness. We have to, if we're going to be in a monogamous relationship, we have to figure out ways to trick the brain into producing more dopamine, which means novelty, which means making love in new places, going away on romantic weekends. You wrote a whole book about that, didn't you, Pepper?
I think it's true. If we have to put a little bit more energy into making a relationship have some interesting new things to it, because we are an animal that perks up at something new, you know, whether it's seeing new pictures or it's, you know, making love in the kitchen as opposed to the bedroom, or wearing a new dress or lingerie, or going to a vacation. You know, why do people talk about great sex and vacations? It's still them. But there's something about the ambiance, the new kinds of environments, the discovery of a road trip or something, that really changes the way you feel about each other.
It does, and it may even help you to laugh a little more and be more playful. You talk a lot about that in your books. And, of course, we know that humor has detoxifying and diffusing abilities.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they go a long ways to keeping relationships intact. And I think humor is so necessary in the bedroom. Go ahead.
I was going to say a lot of what happens in the bedroom is humorous. You better laugh at it.
Yeah, I know it. and even being silly. And Steve Allen Jr., and we were at a party where he was, you remember, in Indiana?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's the son, of course, of Steve Allen, the comedian. And Steve Allen Jr. is the, he's a MD, and he's also a sex educator. And he wrote an article in the early 90s in Longevity Magazine, talking about the importance of silliness in the bedroom, and that the original word silly comes from Old English salag, which meant four things originally. It meant to be happy and healthy and prosperous and blessed. And he thinks that being silly in the right context is a way to achieve all four things. And I agree with him.
Yeah, I think it's great insight.
Yeah. So the way you ended your book, because we're about to end the show.
Okay.
And you're with your friend Dom in Bali. And he says, good memoirs are about authors taking risks, aren't they? And you said, yes, I think they are. And you said, I propose a toast to risk-taking, to sweet moments in life, and to the many ways we can love and be loved. Cheers, Pepper. That's wonderful. That just gets it.
Check, please.
Yeah. Well, you know, I still feel that way, that there are risks when you're single. There are still risks when you're relationship, of growing together, saying the things that need to be said, trying something new. And when you're single, it's, you know, taking the risk to love someone, to know someone, find out about them. There are risks in changing one's life. There are risks in keeping it together. It's It's the name of the game. We might as well enjoy it.
Might as well enjoy it. Until next week. We have to say thank you very much. We have, unfortunately, run out of time. But Pepper Schwartz, your website is drpepperschwartz.com. Folks, look at it. She's got lots of wisdom, and she's wonderful to be on the show. Till next week, everybody. This is Bill Sage for Dr. Diana Wiley and Dr. Pepper Schwartz saying, keep it juicy. Aloha.
Aloha.
Yeah. Pepper, thank you.